When you hear a really great song on the radio, you might have the urge, especially if no one's watching, to react in a couple of ways. Maybe you'll shred a little air guitar. Maybe you'll whip out your invisible drums and, I don't know, beat along. But when you hear a Rush song come on, you really got to consider a third option. Yeah, the elusive air bass. Take a listen. That just reaffirms why Geddy Lee is one of the greatest bass players in rock history. But here's the funny thing. Geddy Lee, while a virtuoso, never really did consider himself a bass aficionado. Like, he was never one of these dudes scouring pawn shops on the weekends trying to find old vintage bass guitars. And he actually didn't know that much about the instrument that made him so famous. All that changed about 6 years ago when Geddy Lee finally started a vintage bass collection. And that inspired him to pull together a whole book called Geddy Lee's Big Beautiful Book of Bass. And it really is beautiful. It's full of photos from Geddy's massive collection, interviews with fellow bass icons like John Paul Jones from Led Zeppelin and Bill Wyman from the Rolling Stones and Adam Clayton from U2. So Geddy Lee stopped by our Q studio, sat right across from me, to take you a little deeper into the world of bass and to talk to you a little bit about what it takes to cultivate that obsession. Geddy Lee, welcome to Q.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Tom.
How are you?
I'm good.
You opened this book by claiming you've always had an obsessive personality. There were stamps, vinyl collecting, baseball, obscure prog. But it took a long time for you to develop that same obsession with the instrument that kind of gave you your life, the bass guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Just first off, why do you think that was? Why do you think you weren't an obsessive about the bass?
Well, I think when you're a working musician, and especially a young one, what you can afford is one thing. You really can't afford to have too many instruments. So you try to focus on the instruments that are going to give you the sound you're trying to develop for yourself, your own identity. And the more musicians I talk to, the more that is sort of a common – it's a shared thing amongst players. The instruments are your tools more than – you know, your things that you want to hoard.
Yeah, you and I talked about that just before we turned the microphones on.
Yeah.
I got two acoustic guitars.
Right.
I know how they sound.
Yes.
And I know when I want to use each one, and that's about it.
Yeah, so the first stage is what's the best instrument I can buy, I can afford to buy? So you start with that and you make do, like the one you were talking about, the world's worst Washburn.
I have this old Washburn, red Washburn acoustic guitar, which is the worst sounding instrument in the entire world. Yeah, for sure.
Well, we all have that worst sounding instrument in the world. So you make do with that. And then when you've scraped enough money together, you buy your first good instruments. So for me, it was a 68 Precision bass that I had saved enough money for. And that became my workhorse and I used it all the time. So you're developing a sound. You're focused on only the things that will give you the results you need and help you develop your identity. And so I was like that for years and years and years. And so I had – there's a picture in the book of me with my original collection from the late 70s, which is five instruments,
oh,
I think.
Wow. Big time.
Yeah. And then so later in my life, when I got turned on to the idea of vintage instruments, and I acquired the first one sort of in 2012 or 2013, a light bulb went on. I felt ignorant of the instrument that I had held in my hands for, you know, over 40 years. It's like, why don't I know about the development of this? Why don't I know about the golden age of those instruments? So I started getting curious, and as I say in the book, being curious for me is a dangerous word.
I related to that so bad, Geddy. It's like my partner says it to me, my family says it to me to say, like, you know, he's written a lot of Wikipedia articles about like Phil Spector or something like that. I'm like, oh yeah, he's on eBay a little bit, you know,
and right.
One by one, curiosity leads to, and eventually you're just – that's all you think about all the time.
Yeah, curiosity kills the cat,
yeah.
Or at least gives you a big collection of stuff you didn't really think you needed.
It kills your bank account. why the bass to begin with? I mean, I was thinking about this when you were starting out. It was sort of the era of the guitar god. There was, you know, there was Clapton and there was Jeff Beck and there was Jimmy Page, these big, you know,
mm-hmm.
the big guitar god age. Why the bass?
Well, no one becomes a bass player willingly, I don't think. You know, you get voted to be the bass player when the bass player that was chosen originally quits. In my case, we were in a little basement band, and it wasn't even a basement band. It was an apartment bedroom band. The guy that was supposed to play bass with us, his mother really didn't like him associating with us, so he left. And then they all looked at me and said, okay, you're going to be the bass player.
Right.
So I went to my mom and I begged her to lend me like $30 so I could buy a bass. And that's sort of how it all started.
You had to work it off at their variety store, right?
Yeah. Every Saturday I'd go to the store with my mom and work it off. Yeah.
Do you still have that one?
No, I don't. I wish I did.
I wonder where it is.
I don't know, but Alex and I both bought similar Japanese imports at the same time, and we both, in a fit of insanity, painted them. They were terrible. They were really ugly, but Alex still has his, and I don't have mine. I don't know what happened to it.
If you were listening to this, because this is going across Canada.
Yeah.
If you were listening to this and you know where Getty's first instrument is.
Yeah, there's a bad self-portrait near the bridge of me and the word blues written across it. So that's the identifying feature.
If you know where it is, drop us a line. We'll hold it hostage at least for a little while.
Please do.
And when did you first key into the sound of the bass in music? I know this is a question you ask in the book. When did you start realizing that the bass was a thing?
I think it was, for me, going to work with my mom at an early age, and even before that, when my dad was still with us, going to work with him. There was always music on in the car. There was always music on in the store. And, of course, in that period, it was Motown. It was, you know, pre-Motown, Motown, a lot of rhythm and blues. And without knowing who, the bass parts of James Jamerson and Duck Dunn and
Legendary bass players, Carole Kaye.
Carole Kaye and even Brian Wilson, Beach Boys, you know. So it was insidious in a way because I picked up on the drum parts and the bass movement. And I remember songs like My Girl and Ain't No Mountain High Enough. I mean, these, they just sort of spoke to me. I've got sunshine. And when eventually I got the job of bass player in my, you know, basement band, I started listening with a different set of ears.
I want to talk a little bit about the evolution of the bass just as an instrument.
Sure.
So when you look at the original days of the bass, Fender launches the precision bass known as the P bass.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, you know, I think a lot of rock and roll bass lines sounded like My Girl. Or that, you know, R&B bass line sounded like My Girl. My first bass line I remember being cognizant of was Stand By Me.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's stuff like this. Just take a listen to this. I was watching a video of Eddie Cochran and his band playing the Summertime Blues, and I saw that old slab, as you call it, kind of boxy P bass in the back of it.
Mm-hmm.
So we start there, and then we go to something more like this. Okay, so that's you.
Yeah, okay, so that's the same genre, isn't it?
So that's Rush on Livia Stragiello. Getty, do we see a correlation between the sound of the bass changing and also the design of the bass changing, the music that's made on it and the shape of it?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the early basses, of course, were supposed to make life easier for the bass player, the guy who was schlepping that giant double bass around the country and tying it on the roof of cars. And mobility was the most important factor, I think. And they jokingly referred to the first P bass as the canoe, the plank and canoe paddle kind of thing. People were resistant to it because there was the tried and true sound of that great upright. But the fascinating part for me was how it got from what I was playing on that song you just played from where the first song started. What was the transition? What was the evolution? I really didn't understand the evolution until I got deep down the rabbit hole.
It is interesting, you know. I was thinking just about the change in tone too, that like bass became through people like you and people like Jaco Pastorius and John Entwistle, sort of a lead instrument as well, and that would have to lead design changes to the bass as well, right?
That's right. And if you listen to the early Motown songs, there's an incredible amount of melody in those pop songs that is kind of insidious. I mean, it's not the melody of the song, but yet if you pull that out, it's kind of a lead part that's playing down in the nether regions of the rhythm section. So what happened, and guys like John Entwistle and Jack Bruce, they led the forefront of pushing that, the tonal capability of that instrument into the range. It dared to cross into the range of the guitar. Turn up the treble, turn up the mid-range, get some twang in there, and start being a little more obnoxious with your playing. And it was those obnoxious guys that I liked.
You think we look pretty good together?
you had a great love for the obnoxious bass player.
I did. Yeah, I wanted to be one.
I think about McCartney on Something. Mm-hmm. I think that was the first time I ever heard the bass as a lead instrument.
Something in the way she moves.
He's almost playing a lead line.
That's right.
Know?
Yeah, and that's not uncommon in the early days of pop. There are a lot of so-called lead lines, but they're played down with the dulcet tones, the lower tones, and so people don't really appreciate that melodic content as a lead instrument, but it really is doing that job.
What I love about the book is, and what I love about your fascination with the bass is that you're a guy, honestly, who could commission some luthier in some country somewhere to deliver the Geddy Lee, the perfect bass that you will play this, and this can do everything I want, and I can switch to any Wild Dog. Was that what it was called?
The Wild Dog. Yeah.
The Wild Dog pickup. I can kind of do anything I want on it. But there is something about the hunt for you, about trying to find the perfect pre-made bass as well, right?
Yeah, it's the Holy Grail. I mean, collecting things for me is a window into time. If you'll notice in the book, anything past 1985, not so interesting to me, but to capture the period, the feel, and to understand what it was like in the 50s to be a bass player and to suddenly see one of these things and to track the evolution of it and into the 60s. And then you see what happens when the Beatles arrive and all of a sudden the demand goes through the roof and these companies are grasping for help and the demand far outweighs their ability to keep producing them the same way. So things start to change. So the whole story of it to me is a window into my past in a way and into it's the story, again, of the development of popular music to a large degree. So that fascinated me.
And you learn about the changing of popular music. You learn about the changing of popular culture in so many ways.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things. There's a lot of styles of music I didn't really know much about. And a lot of these instruments had been verboten to me, by my own decision. Because anything that didn't fit into my soundscape was not anything I was interested in. I had friends that played Gibsons, for example, and I never thought they were the right instrument for me sonically. So I just ignored them, and I knew nothing about their history. So through this, collecting mania, and I picked up the first Gibson, the first Thunderbird, and I plug it in, and I start playing it, and then I look at it like a completely different thing. Now it doesn't have to fit into my soundscape, and I can appreciate it more objectively. And what is this thing? Who made it? And I need to know. And I imagine, like in 63, for example, the first time somebody saw a Gibson Thunderbird, they must have thought, where has that landed from? I mean, come on, it's such a futuristic thing, and it puts you in mind of the 60s, and everything was forward-thinking, reaching out for the stars. So it's very reflective of the things that I grew up with.
That's really interesting to me, the idea that we can see through objects a social history. I find that really fascinating. Mm-hmm. You also talk to some of the – you get some of the stories firsthand. You talk to some of the greatest bass players, most influential bass players of our time. I mean, just to name a few, you have John Paul Jones from Led Zeppelin. You have Adam Clayton from U2. You have Jeff Tweedy from Wilco, who I forgot was a bass player.
Yes. People forget that.
When he was an Uncle Tupelo.
Yeah.
Started out as a collector himself.
Yeah, and really a wild collector. I mean, he's a fantastic array of bizarre and wonderful and interesting and hilarious instruments. I mean, he was just a joy to talk to. And he's a good storyteller, very self-effacing a fine raconteur. We had a great time
together. I can see why you guys got along.
We had a lovely time.
What made you want to reach out to them? What did you want to know?
I thought long and hard about why I should talk to the particular people that we did interview. I wanted to expose, A, people that were influential to me, but also that were representative of the period that the collection is about. Mm-hmm. You know, to talk to John Paul Jones, not only a thrill as he was one of my heroes, but he could tell you what it was like in the music stores of Great Britain in 1960 and what it was like to be a session musician at that period. And talk about how he used to stand in front of the shop windows and stare at this Fender bass in Fiesta Red. And I know that feeling, you know, nose against the glass going, wow, one day I want to have those.
And Bill Wyman making his own. Like,
well, he in,
there wasn't a bass.
No, he invented the first, fretless electric bass.
So for people listening to this, so the fretless electric bass, if I was to play a scale, I would go do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. With the fret, with removing the frets on the neck, I can go there's no break within the
That's a very good description. I'm really impressed.
Oh, thank you. Wow, we can stop the interview right here.
I'm going to use that.
But it's quite amazing. Like he really – one of the most influential bass players of our time, if not the, if you think about it, like this, the rhythm of the Rolling Stones and how that influenced modern music.
And he's what I call a stay-at-home bass player, you know. He shoes the flourishes and the guys like me, you know. He takes a little dig at me at the end.
He does, yeah.
About being a busy bass player. And I can take it. It's fine. But he was a fascinating chap from so many perspectives. First of all, the very first part I had to play to get a gig in a band was 2120 South Michigan Avenue. If you could, in my little neighborhood, if you could play that bass part, you were cool. Mm-hmm. So I learned that bass part, and I got to be able to play with real other players of equal unprofessional status. And so that stayed with me. And when I started thinking about bass players, to me, that's sort of where it all began for me. And I wanted to hear about that bass that he made. I wanted to hear those stories. But when you sit with Bill to talk, he wants to talk about anything else other right. than basses. So we had to – and he was the first interview I did, so I didn't really have my interview chops down. So I had
harder than it looks, eh?
Harder than it looks. So I had to keep reeling him back in and bringing him back to the electric bass.
You know, you can admit it or not, but you know when you do interviews sometimes and you're sitting across from that person who just loves Rush, like mm-hmm. that deep, deep Rush fan, you can kind of tell that they're a little on edge.
Yeah, you can tell.
They're a little nervous.
Yeah.
This is a big deal to them.
Yeah. No, I was nervous talking to Bill.
I was going to say, did you have the same – did you understand how that felt talking to John Paul Jones, talking to Bill?
Yeah. Well, I'd met John Paul Jones before and I knew he was a lovely guy. So he was really a pleasure. Mm-hmm. He was easy. We already had a sort of the beginnings of a rapport. So he was just a pure joy. But sitting down with Bill at first was a bit – nervous, I was a bit tight, and then of course he put me at ease because he's a great raconteur and told all kinds of stories about his life. And I mean, that interview I could have done could have been 25 pages easily. But and some of the other cats were really fun to talk to. And as the more I did, the more fun I was having doing it. So I sort of got into the gig, so to speak.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Geddy Lee, a legendary singer, bass player, musician from the band Rush. He just put out his big, beautiful book of bass, which celebrates his own collection of bass guitars, tells the story of the instrument he loves and has mastered. And I love that what you're looking for here largely is imperfect basses, meaning that they're not ones that have necessarily been kept in cases their entire lives. You,
right.
you like the road warriors, as you call
I do
them.
Like
you
the
do.
Road warriors.
What do you like about them?
First of all, I do like the case queens as well. But what I was really drawn to was the duality, the two different kinds of collectors. And there are these wonderful examples of basses and guitars that have been played and they've made someone a living. They were someone's weekend escape from their day job. They played, you know, beer-soaked bars in Ireland. They've come from every corner of the world. And they have a story to tell. And just looking at them, you can sort of put yourself into that place and into the hands of the guy who loved it for all those years. And so I find it – and invariably those are the best ones to play and they sound the best because they've been broken in. They're like – I guess like a – you know, like a horse that's been ridden and knows exactly – where it needs to go and what it needs to do. Those instruments have a particular magic about them, but they have time. Their scars are visible.
Do you feel that magic? Like some of my favorite moments in this book is you reacting to playing certain basses the same way other people would react to playing your Rickenbackers. Mm-hmm. You're there holding John Paul Jones's bass, and I can see the joy in your face. You're smiling right now.
Yeah, yeah.
You're playing Jaco Pastorius's bass. Jaco Pastorius, maybe not as well known as Led Zeppelin to some, but I would say maybe the most influential bass player we can talk about right now. You might know him from the band, from his group Weather Report. He also played with Joni Mitchell. Can you just tell me that story? Like, do you feel something when you pick up Jaco Pastorius' bass and play it?
Oh, yeah. First of all, you're privileged because you're holding the instrument that was the man's instrument.
You were at Robert Trujillo's house for Metallica,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and Robert – and we tell the story. It's a long, involved story, mm-hmm. but he sort of saved the bass of doom and brought it back to Jaco's family, which he deserves a Nobel Prize for, it, if you ask me. But he's a wonderful cat. So there it was, the bass of doom, and I put it on my lap and I played a few notes and it has that sound, it has that tone, and my God, you know, Robert played it first and I was like, and he started playing some Jaco bits and I was like, yep, that's the thing, that's the instrument, it just has a vibe about it, and all players sense that. And I remember once earlier in the project, before I was deep into the book, I went to visit the current owner of John Entwistle's Frankenstein.
From The Who, yeah.
Yeah. And of course, I wanted to buy it from him, but we couldn't agree on terms.
Oh, my.
But it's a legendary bass because basically he put it together in a hotel room in San Francisco made out of leftover bits of other basses he'd sort of wrecked. And it's anyway, it's a legend, and when I plugged it in, oh my God, it has that tone. It has that Entwistle tone. I mean, of course, I can't play it like he did because I don't have his fingers, but you get a buzz. And when John was at my place in the UK and he was waiting to have his picture taken, he started playing Heartbreaker on the bass that he wrote Heartbreaker on. And you could see everybody in the room just sort of went, he's playing Heartbreaker.
Oh, my God.
And everybody got this big shit-eating grin, if I can say that.
Yeah, sure you can. You can do whatever you want, man. Yeah. Once you get the Order of Canada, you're allowed to swear in the CBC.
All right, okay,
that's how it works. Led Zeppelin and Heartbreaker with John Paul Jones, one of Geddy Lee's heroes on the bass. Before that, you heard Geddy Lee talking about JPJ, John Paul Jones. You're going to hear lots more from Geddy Lee in just a minute. We're going to talk a little bit about his time in Rush, the future of that band, and we might even talk a little bit about baseball from one of Canada's best-known baseball fans. More with Geddy Lee coming up after this. You're listening to Q on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM 169, and from PRI and Public Radio International. I'm Tom Power. You know what I almost said? I'm Tom Power. I'm Turn That Up. Turn That Up! Oh my God! That is a bit of Geddy Lee, one of the greatest bass players in the history of rock and roll, shredding on YYZ, not YYZ, YYZ by Rush. Geddy Lee recently stopped by the Q Studios to take you through his latest project. Geddy Lee's big, beautiful book of bass. He also took some time to look back on the band Rush that got him to where he is today and to consider the future of Rush 2. And I also had to ask him about the Toronto Blue Jays, because if you've ever watched a Blue Jays game on television, right behind home plate, I'd say, you know, maybe two rows behind home plate, there's Geddy Lee sitting, taking in the action, scoring the game. So we're going to talk a little bit about that in just a minute. First, though, here's Geddy Lee with more of Fascination with the bass guitar.
Is there a white whale? Oh, no, not a white whale, because a white whale would imply you never did get it. But is there a bass in the book that is the most meaningful to you that you didn't know if you'd be able to include, but you managed to track it down?
There's a few of those, but I would say the rarest book, just in terms of collectability or just so few exist, is the 4005 L Rickenbacker Light Show.
There's like three of them or six of them? We're
not really sure how many got made. Nobody really knows how many were made. Not even Rickenbacker know exactly how many were made. We think about five. So the rumors are anywhere between five and eight were made. We know John Entwistle had one, but his disappeared. We've only really tracked down three today that still exist. I mean, it's kind of a novelty instrument because it's a big, thick thing. It's full of, lack of a better description, Christmas lights. And as you play the thing, it all lights up. So it was a perfect reflection of the age of Aquarius, you know. We have a few of those instruments that we're trying to capitalize on the late 60s hippiedom, and this bass was made in early 70s. So it was Rickenbacker's answer to smoke a doobie and put on the seeds and jam, man.
Put on Strawberry Alarm Clock, man. Yeah. Don't worry about it. Yeah. That's the only one I was thinking, man, if he brings in a bass, I hope it's like, – I'm dying to see what this thing looks like.
Yeah, it's pretty cumbersome, I should say. But I have a picture that comes – when I bought the bass, there's a – part of its provenance was a picture of a guy playing in a honky-tonk and playing that bass.
Cool.
So, he figured out how to use it.
I love your love of, even though you play the biggest stadiums in the world, I love that you still seem to have such a great love of people who play, 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock in a bar, people playing a hockey rink, people playing in a basement. You still have such an affection for that.
Yeah, because it's so important to their lives to keep their sanity. A lot of guys started out trying to do what I've been able to do in my life, and they weren't successful at it. That doesn't make them any less a musician than I am or any other successful musician. They just had the realities of life interfere with their dream. And so they do their job happily. They raise their family happily. But, on the weekends, they get their yayas out, and that was their instrument that they used to do that. Mm-hmm. So I love what that represents. I love the happiness that it brought those people.
And I love – it must have made you a little bit reflective, like especially the last chapter of the book where it's largely about your rig. It's about the Rush rig over the years. That must have made you a little bit reflective.
Oh, yeah. I mean it's been a time of reflection for me in my career and I struggled with that chapter because I wanted it more to be about my collection. But I realized that in and of itself, my show instruments, my recording instruments, are kind of a separate collection unto themselves. And they do have stories to tell. And there are a lot of my fans out there that want to see them up close and hear all about how I use them and why I use them, et cetera. So, it was very reflective.
How are you doing with all that stuff now, by the way? The band's been off the road now for how long?
3 years.
How you doing?
I'm good.
Yeah? Yeah? You're doing all right? I mean, I wrote
this big book I didn't mention, and that kept me busy.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Like, did you need to be done touring, Budokan? Did you need to be done touring the world in order to sit down and write this book?
Well, let's put it like this. I think the book was very good for me to do because it took me out of that context of suddenly the band is not working anymore. What the hell am I going to do with myself? I had a new project, and I am an amateur photographer, and I am a mental case collector. And so this was a very healthy place to put all those things. And also learning how to produce a book like this is really interesting. And I've got a good friend who's big into projects. He always tells me the key to life is projects. So This was a project, and every project you get involved in stretches your mind, especially when it's in new territory. So making a book like this is really not sitting down in a typewriter and sharing your inner thoughts. It's a big Cecil B. DeMille production. Yeah. And so I had to learn all about publishing and learn about making coffee table books. And so it stretched my brain, and that's a good thing.
You and Alex and Neil still talking?
Oh, yeah. We talk all the time. Alex is he's my buddy, and he lives near me. So we make sure we get together and drink my wine every once in a while.
Yeah, he says that at the beginning of the book. He helps you drink your wine.
He helps me drink my wine. And the two of us go out and visit Neil whenever we can. And so we're in contact. We're still really good pals.
I hope at some point – I'm not going to ask the question, but I hope at some point you guys play together again because I want to see it. I never got to see it.
Yeah, well, I would too.
For no other reason, Getty, but Tom Power wants to see another Rush show.
Guys, we have to get back together.
Did you guys ever play Newfoundland?
Yes, we did. I got to kiss the cod in Newfoundland.
Oh, well, pretty good.
I have my certificate and my bottle of Newfie Screech.
And you kissed it and you said, no, I'm going to choose fine wine. I'm going to choose this. And before we let you go, I just want to tell you on behalf of all Torontonians at least, what a joy it is when we see you at the Jays game.
Oh, thank you.
I have a couple of friends who text whenever it's, you know, when the game's on, someone will say, you got to tune in, Getty's there.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I get a lot of phone calls from out-of-towners when Toronto's playing their home team. And they say, hey, I see you. What's happening? Wave at me. It's like, no, I don't wave. I don't do that. That's not cool.
Are you a stats guy? Do you know your win-loss when you're there?
Yeah, I'm a stats guy. I'm one of the few people on earth that still scores baseball games.
I see you do that, yeah.
Yeah. And on this year, I started not doing it because I realized that I was working too hard during the game and I was missing just having fun. So I went to a few games and I didn't score. And of course, one of the games I didn't score was James Paxton's no-hitter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yep. This is the reason you score a game is so in case you have a no-hitter, you have the score sheet. That was one game I decided I wasn't going to score. And of course, he throws a no-hitter. So big thrill, but
do you know the Getty Lee win loss? Like when
no,
you're there?
No, I don't.
That stat does it. We should track it down. I think that stat does exist.
Yeah, but my brother likes to kid me that you shouldn't go because they're losing too much when you're there.
No, I think they usually do well. And you were there when they had the big playoff run, the first big playoff run, you know, a couple of years ago, and that's what I remind you of. Also, my other favorite memories is usually there's someone leans over and tries to talk to you. Mm-hmm. And you're very polite.
I try to be polite. Mm-hmm. I'm a nice Canadian boy.
I appreciate it. Getty Lee, nice to meet you. Congratulations on
Thank
the book.
You. It's great to be here. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to share my craziness.
A Monday warrior, mean stride. Today's Tom Sawyer, mean pride.
That is Rush from Moving Pictures, 1981, Tom Sawyer. Still their highest-selling album ever. Big thank you to Getty Lee for dropping in. If you want to revisit that interview or share it with the deep bass playing nerd in your life, go to cbc.ca/Q to find out. That is Rush and Tom Sawyer from Moving Pictures.